I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Bass, owner of the Strand Bookstore in New York City. The store was founded by Fred's father, Benjamin, in 1927. Fred was born in 1928 and has been working in the family business since he was 13 years old. The Strand is located on 12th Street and Broadway and has roughly 2.5 million used, rare, and new books, which is the equivalent of about 18 miles of books. Fred owns the Strand Bookstore with his daughter, Nancy Bass Wyden. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So I typically have founders on the show, since it is a show about the entrepreneurial life, but I think that given that you're in your late 80s, you have some street cred.
Well, I've been running the store since for over 50 years. I was involved in mainly moving to where we are now. So the location we have, I would say I more or less founded that. But
yes.
But I'm not a founder. My dad founded it, and he was excellent. He was a great bookman.
Your father was from Lithuania, and before he started the bookstore, he was in manufacturing. Is that right?
What happened was he worked on 4th Avenue. There was some building there. I think it still exists. That sold cloth. And as a young man, he got a job there. That was 4th Avenue, which was Book Row of America. So he hung around the bookstores, and he got caught in it. He was a big, great reader, a great literary man. He knew his books, and he wasn't a great businessman, but he was. Mm-hmm. But most of us booksellers aren't, so.
Now, were his parents erudite and scholarly? Or
I doubt it.
They came from Lithuania also with him.
No. Yeah. I just remember my grandfather being more of a certain point. He was a carpenter, a very good carpenter. And at a certain point in life, he decided that wasn't what he wanted to do. So he became what they call a Talmudic scholar, which meant a bum. He didn't have to work. Other people should support him.
Well, that's one interpretation. So your father worked on 4th Avenue, which is like downtown Park Avenue.
Yes.
That at the time was called Book Row. He opened up this bookstore called The Strand, which was one of 48 bookstores at the time.
That's right.
Why were there so many bookstores concentrated in this one area?
It seemed to be a publishing and printing area, too. There were a lot of publishers in the area, and or had been. So they sort of, you know, congregated together.
Why is the Strand the only bookstore left from that era?
My interpretation of what happened there, okay, because I grew up with the booksellers there. The 48 booksellers were there were very strong individuals. Great bookman, knew a lot about books, about rare books, used books, everything else. They also were very self-centered people, and they didn't teach anybody anything. Only two sons of 48 booksellers went into the business.
You being one of them?
Being one of them, and Donald Weiser being another. And that was my interpretation. Mm-hmm. Another interpretation was they grew old. There was nobody to take over, and when rents went up, they couldn't cope with it, so they just disappeared.
In this story, your father features prominently because he founded the bookstore. Your mother, where was she in all of this?
Well, she died when I was 5 years old. So, I mean, she was, you know, we used to live on 8th Street, right near Tompkins Park, as a kid. And then I remember her dying there. But I didn't understand what dying meant, so, you know.
So her name was Shirley.
Shirley Vogel.
How did she die?
Cancer.
Did your dad remarry?
After a number of years, he did, yes.
Do you remember your mom well?
No.
It's interesting. I have a 5-year-old son, and it's interesting to think that, God forbid, something happened to me, that he wouldn't remember me in his 80s. But I guess that's what happens when you're only five.
Yeah. I saw a picture of her recently, and it completely threw me. That's what she looked like, because I did have a rough impression of what she looked like. It was different. You know, I didn't realize what the word mother meant until my son was born. And I saw my wife being a mother to him. But you know, at 5 years old, 6 years old, you don't know the difference.
And do you feel like your dad took on a more prominent role, given that he was the only caregiver?
Yes, yeah, of course, definitely. Yeah. It was depression time, too, and he worked very hard, and it was at very rough times.
What are your earliest memories of you with your father?
Well, actually, my earliest memories of him are in the bookstore. We used to walk over to the store all the time, and I'd hang around there. I mean, I could have been 9, 10, 11 years old. And occasionally, he'd put me to work sweeping and doing things like that. That's my earliest recollection of him.
Why did he call it the Strand?
Twofold. We're not quite sure. After the Strand in London, which was a literary street, so that was the interpretation, and the Strand magazine, which is also a literary thing. So we're not quite sure where he got it from. Probably a combined thing of both. Mm-hmm. Actually, the original store was called the Penguin.
The Penguin?
But he immediately had to change that because the publishing firm already had that name, and which he did, but it was just a very short thing.
Did he ever tell you about how he went about founding the store? He had $300 of his own money and $300 from a friend.
That's right. One of the early recollections was of going on the subway, where he picked up a load of books and carried them on the subway back. You know, I helped him carry them, and I always remember the rope cutting into my hands.
You said you would pick up books. Now, you're talking about used books you would get from people's homes or estates.
Right.
Do you remember specific stories of homes you went into, you know, kind of uncovering these treasures?
Not early, but later on. You know, early we just got used books wherever we could.
You grew up in the book business with your father. Mm. You went to Brooklyn College in the morning, but in the afternoon you would help your father in the shop.
You know, I scheduled my classes from 8 o'clock to 12, which really determined what courses I took.
Yeah.
And at 12 o'clock I'd get on the subway and come back into New York and work. I lived in the Bronx, so I called Brooklyn College the closest thing to an out-of-town college I could go to.
Was there any question that you would work in the book business in your mind?
Everybody was telling me not to.
Including your father.
Including my father. He said it just was too hard. It was too difficult at the time. But I got hooked. And I'm still hooked by it. I mean, I love what I'm doing. I'm a lucky man. I'm working at a job I like. I mean, I let my daughter run the operation and have her staff and everything else. Mm-hmm. I keep an eye on what things are going on. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to work at that buying counter because that's the fun. That's the treasure hunt. Every morning I come down there and we don't know what we're going to get over the counter or what libraries we're going to unpack because we get a lot of stuff shipped into us and what we're going to find.
What treasures do you find? What did you find most recently, or what features in your mind of things you found in the past?
Well, two of the exciting things that I thought I found, we bought right over the counter, people coming in with them, was a copy of James Joyce's Ulysses, the original first edition, the original paper, the whole thing. And a lawyer came in, he had a part of an estate, he told us what he wanted for it, and we decided to buy it. It was just a great, great thing to have.
When was this?
Oh, about 15 years ago.
What do you buy a book of that nature for? What is the general amount?
I think it was about $7,000 or $8,000. Now it's worth $30,000, $40,000, maybe $50,000. And connected with that was another thing that I get a big kick out of because it's a fun book to have. It's James Joyce's Ulysses, illustrated by Matisse. They're very nice, they're very elaborate, and he signed the book, and James Joyce came along to sign his copies of the book and looked at the illustrations and said, "These aren't to my book." Mm-hmm. Matisse did it to the original Ulysses, and he only signed some of them. And we've got a copy of one of them signed by both. And since I collect Matisse material, I thought this is one of the gems. Another thing we got over the counter, which was very exciting, a man came in with the second folio of Shakespeare, which we ended up selling for $100,000.
These are just people walking in off the street. You never know what they're going to pull from their bag.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, in addition to people coming to you to sell books, you go to people's homes in New York.
Yes.
What are some interesting memories that you have of walking into somebody's home and picking up books? Or
it just seemed I was doing it forever. I would travel everywhere to do it. Now we don't have to do as much of that because most of the stuff is sent to us or brought to us. The store is like a hungry monster. It's got to be fed. I'm shocked myself how much stock we have to put into it every day. We have a system where we're replacing inventory on a daily basis from our Brooklyn warehouses. And a full truck comes along with 60, 70 boxes a day coming in there.
Do you feel, though, that that demand has dissipated since there's this sense of the internet and people reading less? Do you feel that demand has softened?
Yes and no. It's a hard thing to answer, but in some ways it's helped us. For instance, my biggest competitor is probably Amazon because it's, you know, just easy to get them. Mm-hmm. My biggest customer is Amazon. They've given us a new market and taken away part of our market, too. So I just feel that people are getting more and more into some books. And I think the Kindle has, in a way, stimulated a lot of stuff.
I want to continue to talk about the early days and your the influence that the store had on you. In addition to working at the store in the afternoons during Brooklyn College, you also served for a time in the Korean War. And there's a story of you. You had 2 weeks off, and you spent one of those weeks at the store while your dad could go on vacation.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And did you see that?
How'd you dig up that story? Oh, my God.
Oh, Fred. So did you see that as a burden, or did you think, yes, this is where I want to be on my week off?
I felt it was something I had to do. You know, my dad was running sort of a one-man operation, practically. You know, there were tough times, and yet he needed a little break. And also, I got paid a little money for it, so that helped. I had a little more pocket money, so.
Where did you serve?
I actually ended up serving in Germany.
Do you remember reading during those 2 years?
Oh, sure, yeah. We had access to books that were banned in the United States. The Henry Miller things, mostly. Pornography.
Oh, I don't know Henry Miller.
It was pretty graphic in his sexual things, and he was very good. He was a little outrageous. And I remember when I got out of the Army, I smuggled in a whole batch of them from Europe. I put them in my footlocker, and I got them in here. But I would have been arrested.
Did you sell them at the Strand?
We sold them at the Strand.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Bass, owner of the Strand Bookstore in New York City. We'll hear more from Fred coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Bass, owner of The Strand, a bookstore in Manhattan with roughly 200 employees and 18 miles of books. The store was founded by Fred's father, Benjamin, in 1927. Fred's father, Ben, started The Strand in 1927 with $600 when he was 25 years old. Since the store opened, The Strand has been the home of book enthusiasts, authors, publishers, journalists, editors, and people who just love books. Fred co-manages The Strand with his daughter, Nancy Bass Wyden. Your dad's store was on 4th Avenue. What building was it in? Do you pass that building today? Is the building still standing?
Oh, no, they tore it down. The block we were on was on 4th Avenue between 10th and 11th Street. And the block was owned by the last of the Stuyvesant family. They owned the farm and the land there, and this was the last of them. And a little story connected with that was that during the Depression, Stuyvesant refused to kick anybody out as long as they paid a little. Of course, you had to pay it back. And I remember my dad said we ran 3 years behind in rent.
Was it an act of kindness that Stuyvesant said, just pay me a little until...
Maybe it was just his business thing and saying, you know, empty stores don't bring in any money. You get a little money out of them.
Yep.
Better than nothing. And if I kick tenants out, they're going to rot, and that's it. And we did pay him back. I remember my dad being very proud about paying him back.
3 years worth of rent.
Well, it's about 3 years. You know, we paid back a little extra, but it was a little extra each month until we caught up. And the story I always like to repeat was that during the war, there was rent control on real estate, commercial real estate.
World War II.
World War II, yeah. The Stuyvesant came along and asked the tenants there for a 15% increase. And there were 5 bookstores on the block, and each one of them refused to give them the 15% increase. But we did, because they'd been so nice to us. And then there was a second one, 15%, that occurred a year later or something like that, and we gave it to them too. Then the rent control was taken off, And they came along and they doubled the rent on everybody but us. They left us alone. So, you know, it's just a nice story I always like and remember it at the time.
What else do you remember about your father other than his work ethic and his love of books?
He loved my stepmother, I know that. And he was very happy with the children. And, of course, he was great with my grandchildren, with our children, too. He was fantastic, grandparent.
How was it working with him?
Challenging. We'd fight all the time. He just didn't understand why I was buying so much stuff and I was doing so many different things and, you know, going in different directions. And I could see it happening with my daughter, too, except she whined more. We all had different ideas, and he had an old-fashioned idea of how to run a place.
What were some changes or additions that you brought in that you feel really helped the business in an important way?
Well, the remainders.
What are remainders?
Exactly? Publishers overstock from the publishers. Mm-hmm. We buy both a tremendous amount here in the States and in England. And it's not just junk. A book can, the way I like to describe it is, a publisher can publish a book and sell 50,000 copies of it, and then print another 50,000 and sell them, and maybe even sell 200,000 copies of it. And then he's got 10,000 left, and they stop selling. Well, here's a book that's a winner, sold 200,000 copies. We buy up some other stuff and sell it at a much cheaper price. That's it.
In 1957, you moved to your current location on 12th Street and Broadway.
That's right.
So this was roughly 30 years after the original store had opened.
Yeah.
That was at your impetus? Was your dad was
well,
still...
Well, we lost the our lease on 4th Avenue because the building was coming down. The whole street was coming down. My dad wanted to go into a mail order operation, and I said we'd starve. And he agreed with me, so we found this location.
What was in the location?
Well, it had originally been a clothing store. Only the front part of the main floor did we take over at that time. And when I took it over, I started expanding. And little by little, I just kept taking more and more space from my landlord. He and I became great friends, but he still was a landlord, and he still was a tough SOB, I'll say that. And eventually I was able to buy the building from him. And we negotiated at Knickerbocker Bar and Grill on University Place. I negotiated at the bar two leases with him for a long period of time, and I bought the building at the bar. We'd meet there every Tuesday, have a couple of drinks, fight for a little while, then have dinner and go to a jazz club.
When I learned that you owned the building, I thought, well, maybe the building is worth more than the Strand bookstore business. You know, it's a 12-story building.
Yeah. Well, right now we're at the pretty top of a real estate market in New York. Yes, it probably is worth more than the bookstore. And it's very tempting at times to either sell off the building at an outrageous price or rent out the space at outrageous prices and just close down the store. But my daughter, who now makes that final decision, wants to keep it going because she likes doing it.
And you love it. What would you do if you did that? I don't see you retiring.
Well, I'd get drunk all day, that's all. Now I don't have time to drink, that's all.
Are you married?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I do have a wife. I've been married 65 years.
What's her name?
Patricia Ruth Bass.
Does she help you in the business at all?
No, she doesn't work in the business at all. No.
And how many children do you have?
Right now, I have a daughter. Mm-hmm. My son died. So my daughter's running it, and she's got quite a challenging life. I don't know if you know this. Of course you do. She's married to Ron Wyden, the senior senator from Oregon.
Yes. I was wondering about where she's living.
Well, she's living in New York, running the store, and they go back and forth. He comes up practically every other weekend. Now she's out in Oregon with him, with the kids and everybody else. So
the Strand is somewhat of an iconic New York institution. You see people walking around in Strand T-shirts and bags. And did you have a sense for when the bookstore was becoming even larger than itself? Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes, I did, really. But it goes back a long time ago, because at one time we were really very unique. There weren't any bookstores our size. We were long. I mean, this is before Barnes & Noble's opened up their giant stores. We had a store that was 20,000 square feet. There are no bookstores around 20,000 square feet anywhere in the country.
I don't think it's just because of your size, and maybe you did have the books, but there's something else.
Well, one of the things I think that helped the store an awful lot was that we started getting these reviewers' copies.
What are reviewers' copies?
Complimentary copies that are sent by publishers to individual reviewers, magazines, journals, newspapers, to places like the Times Literary Review and all that, for somebody to review and hoping they get free publicity out of this. We bought the reviewers' copies from them, and we made a market, and then we sold them at half price. So they were brand new books. You could come to the Strand and get a book that was just published at half price if I had it. And that has helped our business quite a bit. But part of this is reviewers would come in and bring their copies to us and sell them to us, and then they started hanging around the store, and there was sort of a literary thing with them, and there were some great people that come in the store and, you know, made some great friends. Anatole Breuard, who used to be a lead reviewer for the Times, and that were there all the time. And with them, you got other people, you know. But the real reason was that we got the books, and we put them out at a good price. And that was my forte of buying as much as I could and getting as much, you know, and going after the books, not just sitting back. So we were very aggressive. And then I was able to develop a staff that was literary and were really interested in the books and helped, you know, with the selections. And
you have a loyal staff. You have members who have been with you for the last 40 years.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's one employee, Ben McFall.
Yes.
Who has been with you since 1978, for example, and
he helps people
with their fiction books.
Yeah.
What do you think your staff would say about you?
I don't even think about it. I hope they like work with me. I don't know. I have no illusions about it. I'm the boss. People generally hate bosses. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have no illusions that my staff loves me or anything like that. I just try and work with them at a reasonable level and behave myself. I think most of them like me. And most of them enjoy working with me. But, you know, it's... But there's always somebody with a chip on their shoulder.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Bass, owner of The Strand, a bookstore in Manhattan with roughly 200 employees and 18 miles of books. Fred's father, Ben, started The Strand in 1927 with $600 when he was 25 years old. Since the store opened, The Strand has been the home of book enthusiasts, authors, publishers, journalists, editors, and people who just love books. Fred co-manages The Strand with his daughter, Nancy Bass Wyden. You mentioned before that it was challenging to work with your father, and now there are challenges working with your daughter.
Well,
And she's been, you know, you mentioned that you were aggressive, and in a way she's been aggressive in making changes. What are some of the changes that have occurred in the last 10, 20 years?
I think one of the major things she's done is a bigger training program for new employees, putting more systems in to be able to control hiring a better staff. So these people, you know, they won't tolerate any incompetence, let's put it that way, or lying or cheating and things like that. And that helps a lot. She's also got a creative drive of trying to expand what we're doing. And she's made the displays at the store a lot more attractive.
Yeah, so there's been de-shelving in a way.
Well, I'll tell you the story with the thing. We used to have one of the things that was always a big problem in the store, any bookstore, any business, is security. So we used to have a counter up front. It was a double-sided counter. And you came in one side and you had to check your bags. And when you left, you could pick up the bag on the other side. And that sort of controlled some of the stealing. So there were generally three people involved. And when it was really busy, there were more people than three taken there. And it took up a lot of space up front. And one of my smarter managers, I have to say that, they, you know, got the feedback, said, you know, Fred, I've been watching what goes on up there. 10 people come in, and of the 10 people that come in, one is asked, one will refuse to check his bag and walk out. So that's 10%.
You're losing business.
And I discussed this with my daughter. But she came along and she said, look, I can put three tables in that area and they're going to bring in $800 a week. Well, that's, you know, $2,400 a week. Am I losing that much in stealing? We got rid of the security and made tables into it and made it more comfortable to come in. Now you can walk around the store with bags and stuff like that.
Because now you have video surveillance.
We have video surveillance. We got undercover things going. We prosecute everybody. No tolerance. This is amazing, the people we've caught.
What do you mean?
Professors, lawyers, one guy who worked for the police department, customers that for 30 years. They'll come in and say, hi, Fred, good to see you. And then suddenly, you know. But that's not a major problem in our store. Most people are honest. The second part of this that occurred was the buying counter. It used to be at the side of the store. As you came in to the right side of the store, there was a counter there where we used to do all the buying. And my daughter came along and says, I can put a couple of tables there. You want to move the buying counter down to the basement? And I said, no, I'm not working in the basement, period. That's it, you know. So we compromise and I work in the back of the store. I'm not happy about it. I'd rather be up front where all the action's going and seeing it, but those tables are worth more money than keeping me happy, okay?
I see just walking around people wearing Strand T-shirts and carrying Strand bags. How do you feel when you're walking on the street and you happen to see somebody in?
Oh, very, very happy.
Still?
Yeah. Still very happy, yeah.
That doesn't subside?
No, it doesn't subside at all, yeah. And when I'm out of the country and I see somebody with them, I'll go over and say hello.
What countries have you been to where you've seen people wearing a T-shirt?
I've been to France and Germany. I was in Italy, obscure town. Some guy comes in wearing a T-shirt and his wife is carrying a Strand bag. And I walked up there. And they were actually from Norway.
Why do you think people like wearing your clothes?
It identifies them with a literary world and intellectual world. And another story I like to tell, but I probably shouldn't be saying it, was we used to have some policemen who always hung around the store when we closed. And one day, one of the policemen comes up to me and says, hey, can we get a couple of T-shirts? I said, sure. So I gave him, he says, yeah. He says, we go down to the Jersey Shore during the weekends. We wear these things. And the girls think we're intellectuals.
Do you wear Strand T-shirts? Do you wear Strand clothing?
I do occasionally, yeah.
Around the house or?
Around the house or, you know, weekends or, you know, played a lot of tennis. I played a lot of platform tennis where you wear sweatshirts and things of that and heavier stuff. And I always wore the Strand shirts. And
what celebrities have hung out around the store? Do you remember?
Oh, God, I have a whole list. Anna Strasberg, who was the widow of Lee Strasberg of the Actors Studio, or the actor himself. Used to come in the store all the time, and I'd supply her with books and things like that. And I'd always say to him, I think you got it, because Lee had an incredible, incredible library. I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. She says, yeah, but I can't find it. So one day she calls me and says, would you, she asked me for two books. I said, you want me to send them up? She said, no, I want you to give them to Sophia Loren. But she said, just Sophia. But anyhow, she shows up at the store. I have the books on my desk. I give it to her. She says, no, I want you to give them to yourself. Drags me out, shoves me into the back of a car, and I'm sitting next to Sophia Loren. And I said, oh, my God, you know, gorgeous. Actually, handsome, the most gracious thing. She said, I want to apologize to you for not being able to come into the store and thank you for getting these books.
Why couldn't she come in?
Mobbed. And she said, you know, if I come in there, there'll be people running over right away, autograph this and that. She said, I would love to come back sometime when, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, well, look, we'll keep the store open all night for you. Yeah, but it was a nice, you know, just a nice touch the way she did it.
Yes.
And very gracious, you know.
Do you have any interesting memories from the store that, do you ever remember having a day or a week where you thought, this is the best? Life is wonderful. I just, you know, where you have like those really high moments of work where you just feel.
I get them very often. I still get them. I mean, it just happened to be that last week was one of the top weeks we've ever had. That was not holiday. Yeah, I mean, that wasn't, you know, Christmas or stuff like that. And it was the top day for the year. And to happen during the summertime in the doldrums, even with one fully rainy day. And it's not just the numbers. It's the fact that you're pouring out so many books. There's so many people involved. It's, I still get those days right along. And that's why I'm there. I'm one of the luckiest people in the world. I'm doing work I want to do, and I can still handle it, so I do it. I'm 88 years old, and my brain is half there, but it's half there. Yeah, my sight is still good enough to read titles.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for the privilege of getting on your show. That's very nice. Yeah.
Thank you. My guest has been Fred Bass, owner of the Strand Bookstore. Coming up, we'll meet Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
A smiling face, a fireplace, a cozy room. A little nest that's nestled where the rose is bloom. Just Molly and me, and baby makes three. We're happy in mind. New heaven.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits, a hardware company that produces electronic modules that snap together with magnets. These electronic modules are accessible to both children and adults, and the company's goal is to encourage creativity and invention by making electronics easier to use. Little Bits was launched in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya graduated with a degree in computer engineering from American University in Beirut and has a master's from the MIT Media Lab. Aya is also an interactive artist. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Lebanon. You were always encouraged down the engineering route. How come?
So I actually wanted to be a designer when I was in school, but I was very good at math and science. And so my family, my parents and my teachers told me that I owed it to myself to be an engineer. And I went into engineering because it was sort of the thing to do. But very quickly, I realized that engineering was very dry and very much not creative. And I felt like there was a big piece of my brain, like my the creative portion, that was really not engaged. And so those were the seeds of some of the work that I ended up doing with Little Bits.
And also, you are an interactive artist, meaning that you are using technology in your art. Mm. And your focus is on perceptions of Arabian identity. One of your works is Arabia. Tell me about that.
So that was a project that came from a personal place. I had moved to the U.S. For a couple of years, and more frequently than I thought, I would get comments from people that say, "Oh, you're Arab. How come you're not wearing a veil? You're Arab. Are you able to belly dance?" And I would get these like very polarized cliches thrown at me all the time, and I'd never thought of these things when I was growing up. And so, Arabia was basically a piece that I developed for a fashion show. It's a belly dancing outfit, and you have the model, the dancer, comes out to the stage and performs this really beautiful, very sensual dance. And then at one point, she flips a switch on her outfit, and through motors, the outfit starts to close on itself and turns into a burqa, just showing these two extremes of stereotypes associated with Arab women.
You're using technology and electronics in your artwork, playing with the two, and that's what you're encouraging people to do through Little Bits, basically, just to create and be inventive. What are some examples of some of the projects that the general public creates with Little Bit kits?
At the root, what we are doing our mission is to put the power of electronics in everyone's hands and make anyone an inventor. We've been described as Lego for electronics or Lego for the 21st century. So they are bricks that instead of being plastic, are lights and sounds and sensors and motors. And with the same ease, you can start using them. Kids have used them to learn about electronics or to create line-following robots. They've created, yesterday we saw a kid who made a flute that makes soap bubbles as he's blowing into the flute through a fan and some sensors. Also things that, you know, there's a lot of energy and attention towards the Internet of Things now. And we do have, with little bits, this ability to attach the Internet to anything so that you can bring appliances or devices at home to life and make them controllable with your phone. So we've seen people, for example, make something like a remote pet feeder so that if you're at home at the office and your pet is hungry, you can, through your phone, press a button and have a little motor turn a cup of food for your pets so you can feed them remotely.
You, in 2008, came up with the idea or the early prototypes for Little Bits, but it wasn't until 2011 that you actually launched the company. And it was your boyfriend who encouraged you to kind of stop everything else that you were doing. What's the story there?
So in about April 2011, I had been working on Little Bits as a project, as one of my projects for a few years, and I had gone and found a factory to make it, and was doing prototypes. And in April 2011, I got the first shipment of a prototype from a factory that I'd been working with in China, and for the first time, I basically saw that Little Bits was manufacturable. And simultaneously, I'd been getting a good amount of press that was interested in the concept of kind of making electronics accessible to kids and adults. And so people would write in wanting to place orders. And so my boyfriend said, you have a product that's manufacturable and you have a customer that wants it. You need to stop everything else you're doing and start a company. And it was kind of like, oh, yeah, why not?
Is he still your boyfriend?
He's my husband now, yes.
Where did you meet him?
I met him in New York, actually. He co-curated a show with MoMA, with Paola Antonelli, called Design and the Elastic Mind, that was about design and science. He was chairing the conference, and I was giving a talk there.
In 2011, shortly after you launched, there was an exhibit at MoMA, or the Museum of Modern Art, where Little Bits was displayed, and Little Bits is now in the permanent collection. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So there was an exhibit called Talk to Me by Paola Antonelli, who's the head design curator. And the exhibit was about the interaction between people and things. And Little Bits was on display in that exhibit. And it was a huge, huge honor because it was with some of the greatest design and technology pieces of the day. Shortly thereafter, they sent me an email saying that they wanted to acquire Little Bits into the permanent collection of the museum.
One of the germs for Little Bits was the creation of the concrete brick, which you've talked about before, invented in 1868. What is the connection of the concrete brick to your modules?
I believe that, you know, the world keeps changing and the technologies of the day are moving fast. And so in the early 1900s, the technology of the day was a concrete brick. That was the way we started to build larger, more complex structures, one brick at a time. And a little bit after, Lego came out with a play version of that brick in order to empower young and the young at heart to be able to play with that technology that was really ruling the world and be able to make buildings and bridges and these beautiful structures one brick at a time.
And they were called the automatic bonding brick?
Automatic bonding brick was the first name that they had. And now the world has changed again. Now the brick is no longer a cement brick. The brick is now a transistor, which is something that is driving all the technologies around us. The devices we carry, our phones, our alarm systems, they all at their node have a transistor. And so what is the play or the imagination version of that brick? How can we put that in the hands of the kids and kids at heart so that they can kind of understand the world and reinvent it? And that's sort of what drove a lot of the work on Little Bits.
What were a few pivot points for you, for the company, where you felt like you were getting traction from the public?
MoMA was definitely one. In September 2011, basically it was the day I launched the company, and at the same time we were acquired into the permanent collection. So it really kind of started us off on a really strong footing and with a lot of confidence and kind of a big stage to play on. And then in February 2012, I became a TED Fellow and I gave a talk at TED, which was also a pivotal moment. It was really a chance to talk about why this is important and why this is important for society, not as a gadget or a toy. It's important as a new way of thinking.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Aya Bedir, founder of Little Bits, a company that sells electronic modules that snap together using magnets. These modules are generally easy to use, making them appealing to the general population, both adults and children. The company was started in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya is also an interactive artist raised in Beirut, Lebanon.
You asked actually on Pivotal Moments. There is one more. Early on in the company, when we launched, we got an email from NASA, from the education department at NASA, saying that they wanted to collaborate with us to create kits to make space and Earth exploration more attractive to kids. And they came to us saying, you know, we need your help. And that was a huge moment. And we collaborated together to create a kit called the Space Kit, which replicates some, to a high degree of fidelity, some experiments that are happening at NASA that make this wonder around space and Earth more palatable and more understandable.
What's an example?
You know, in order to wake up astronauts in the space station, NASA sends wirelessly some music to play music as an alarm. And we have a little experiment where you have a microphone and you're playing music from your phone or an MP3 player, and you're transmitting this wirelessly through infrared to a speaker somewhere else.
Ironic that your family really pushed you hard to become an engineer and go down this route, and you did it resentfully as you really wanted to pursue your art, and now you're back where you started.
Absolutely.
With a twist.
Yeah, with a twist.
What does your mother make of this?
My mother has been a huge, huge influence and inspiration on me. When I was growing up, she was doing her master's when I was about 6 or 8. So I would come home and we would do homework together. And so even though I grew up in the Arab world, I never had any idea that there was sort of a different career choices that women and men made. And she's very supportive today as well.
You are part of the maker movement or the open hardware movement. Can you describe that?
The maker movement is really a movement that started around this idea that we should not be just consuming objects around us, that humans were made to be creative and to make with their hands. And that's how you learn. It's how you connect with friends. It's how you invent. And the maker movement is all about sort of making things for yourselves, whether it's arts and crafts, whether it's making electronics. It's really about putting the power back in the hands of the people instead of just the large companies. I do remember kind of early in the 2000s, you started to really see a world where everything was a screen and everything was virtual and every relationship was happening online. And for a lot of people, myself included, that's not a pretty world that I would like to live in. I believe in the tactile. I believe in feeling the satisfaction of having made something. And so what happened is I think that we realized that software in kind of the cloud or in virtual space, without it being on objects and in objects around us, becomes really intimidating and almost not human. And so now the pendulum swung back again to say, all of the things we learned from software, how can we now embed them into devices of all sizes and spaces that are around us?
You attended the iBeam Art and Tech Center in New York. How important was that in the evolution of Little Bits? And what is it?
iBeam is an art and technology lab and center in New York. That was a very, very, very pivotal moment in my life. I had done engineering, and then I went to the media lab at MIT and was doing sort of engineering and art and doing a lot of research around that subject. And then I graduated in 2006 and got a job in finance And I did finance for 2 years, and I was very, very miserable. And I didn't want to be doing PowerPoints and meeting with hedge funds. And so I quit, and I got a fellowship at iBeam. And at iBeam, I picked up these ideas of incorporating electronic with arts. And then Little Bits was a second project, just to think about, you know, how do I put this ability to use electronics for creativity? How do I put this ability in the hands of other people, not just myself? Which is sort of the genesis of Little Bits.
In addition to selling these modules, the community aspect of Little Bits has really developed. You have something called a Maker Hub, where people are on your site sharing what they've made, as well as BitLab, which is basically an app store for hardware.
So on the first piece, the community, basically, you know, because Little Bits is essentially a system of these electronic bricks, you know, the point is not the bricks, the point is what you make with them. And so we have a space on the website where there are thousands of projects that people have uploaded with step-by-step tutorials for things you can make. You then have kids that are 8 years old and adults that are 45 years old collaborating on an idea.
What's an example?
We have one of our community members that made basically a surf weather alert because he wanted to know when it was a good tide to go surfing. And so basically connected this motor to make a display that's on a beach that reads from weather data to get like high tide, low tide, and basically creates these notifications that go back and forth and tell him now it's a good time to surf. And that's an example of a collaboration that was across different ages and experiences.
I want to talk about the design of the product. They're white circuit boards with very colorful connectors, pink and blue and green. Can you talk to me about some of those choices?
Electronics are always ugly. They're always green or black, and there's wires sticking out everywhere. And they're the thing you put inside something. You make a shell around it to cover them. And part of sort of the challenge was, how do you make electronics not intimidating? How do you make them inviting? And so one of the tools to cross that hurdle is to make them beautiful, make them exposed so they're open. They're not hidden under any box. They're white because it's less sort of scary. They have this handwritten font on them because it makes them feel human. And they have these neon-colored connectors because we want them to be gender-neutral. People gravitate towards them that never would have put their hand on electronics, whether it's kids, particularly young girls, but also entrepreneurs, designers, artists, people that have no engineering training whatsoever or no interest in engineering.
You mentioned gender-neutral. Neutrality. In what ways are you mindful of encouraging girls to pick up the product?
Getting more girls and women into technology is a hidden agenda of the company, but we don't wear it on our sleeve. What we do is make very, very deliberate choices to make sure that the product, the communication around the product, and everything the company stands for is egalitarian.
I want to talk about venture capital for a moment. You've raised a couple...
So fun.
You've raised a few rounds of venture capital. What have been your impressions of that process along the way?
Raising money is not easy in general. But in addition to that, raising money for a hardware company is difficult. I remember early on in one of my pitches, one investor, very, very prominent investor, told me, I love your business. I love everything you're doing. I think it's going to be a smashing success, but I can't invest in you. Your business is too much of a real business for us. There is the reality. There's physical product and raw material and shipping and taxes and warehouses. And, you know, the barrier to being successful is much higher than making a piece of software and getting a million people to use it. So the hardware component adds to the complexity of raising money. I don't actively think about it, but there is an extra stigma of being a woman.
What is one example?
I'd rather not proliferate the anecdotes, and instead I'll say what I learned and what I think is a proactive way to solve it. I think that the generation before us fought a very hard fight, and we stand on their shoulders for being able to do the things that we're able to do. But now we have a different fight to fight, which is do great work. And I think that the best way to succeed is something that actually Sarah Silverman said once in one of her shows, which is just be undeniable. Be undeniable. And And then nobody can come in and say, but she's a woman. It will not happen. And then the third reason why it's difficult to raise money is I got a good piece of advice early on, which is not all money is equal. You can get money from anywhere, but getting the right kind of money or smart money is transformative.
Your modules allow you to do a whole array of things, of one of which most recently is to make music. And you have all these modules in front of me. Can you make some music for me?
Sure. So what I have is a power bit, which is blue, and I'm going to snap it into an oscillator, which is generating the sound wave, and a speaker. And now I'm tuning the oscillator. And then I can put a keyboard. Add a sequencer.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.